Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We're actually Zooming this show on Wednesday morning, so you'll be hearing it, at least originally, at noon on Wednesday, in part because of the debate last night. As we've begun every single show since March of this year, we begin with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. As I've told you over and over again, I want his voice ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise this November. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I almost didn't want to do this discussion this morning because I was so appalled by what happened last night. I wasn't sure how we would actually craft a conversation. But we have to soldier on. So let me explain to you who this fabulous panel of guests is. We have Professor Val Endres. She's a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. Thank you for doing this, Val.
Glad to be here, Arnie.
We have Professor Annalise Orlick. She is a history professor at Dartmouth College. And I want to welcome Annalise to the program. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
We have a reporter and columnist, Robert Hennelly. He writes for Salon.com, The Chief Leader, InsiderNJ.com, and you can find him at Stuck Nation. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul Glastris is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, and I'm very pleased to have Paul with us as well. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Great to be here.
So I had actually contacted Harold Meyerson of the American Prospect, and I said, do you want to join us? And he said, I don't know, Arnie. But at 2 in the morning, I get this little note going, no, I'm not going to join you. He posts his column at the American Prospect. And then I responded going, oh, I'm so sad. And he's going, you're supposed to be in bed. And then I read his very short but pithy piece. And I asked permission from him if I could read it to you as a way to sort of set the stage. Because as I wrote about our conversation I wrote last night, it was not a debate. It was a political abortion, a.k.a. a you-know-what show. I want your thoughts, your reactions, now what? But this is what Harold Meyerson of The Prospect wrote. 4 more years of this jerk, Trump does his reelection campaign no favors. Voting Donald Trump out of office has always been a woefully insufficient solution to the Trump problem. He needs to be voted off the island, off the planet. And last night, he helped ensure that he will be voted out, well, out of office at least. Trump is losing the election, according to polls. He needs additional support in order to change the trajectory. So which swing voters did Trump's performance win over? He already had the Klan and the Proud Boys, whose support he gratefully acknowledged and encouraged. He probably nailed down any stray Cossack still pining for a pogrom, not to mention the terrorists of Anti-Cohn, members of the anti-coherence conspiracy who disrupt sequentially thought on the streets of our cities. Branch out just slightly into larger groups of swing voters, and Trump didn't do as well. Women, for one, may have been reminded of their interactions with angry, overbearing, out-of-control men. Blacks, Latinos, Asian Americans, and Native Americans, if they noted Trump's refusal to condemn white supremacy and call to his backers to flock to polling places to keep people like them from voting, may have experienced a frisson of anxiety. Americans who, as Trump believes, moved to the suburbs for a less stressful life may have found his rage and divisiveness and the prospect of 4 more years of it to be an unwelcome death knell of civic peace. And so on. And he goes on and on and on. And then basically sort of at the end, he writes, The media, seemingly more miffed at the lack of decorum than substance, spent the post-game shows openly calling for no more debates to be held. But after last night, it's not likely that all that many Americans will tune in anyway. Perhaps Mike Bloomberg can offer to pay any remaining swing voters substantial sums of money to watch them in the expectation that the more who watch, the more who will vote to remove Trump from office. And last night's performance? Well, Sheldon Adelson is probably contemplating paying swing voters not to watch. Anyway, there we go. So I'm going to start with you, Paul Glastris, from the Washington Monthly. I looked at last night, and I will tell you, as a female watching it, I've experienced Donald Trump. I've experienced him in my home life. I've experienced him in my business life. I've experienced him in my political life. At one point when I was running for governor, Paul Glastris, one of the Democratic candidates running against me patted me on the head. Patted me on the head. And I looked at him and I was just out of my mind. So it's, to me, very interesting because I would love to have sat with a group of women and I would have loved to at the same time been a split person and sat with a group of men because I think the reaction was incredibly different and I think gender had a lot to do with it. I'm wondering your thoughts. This is Arnie female talking to Paul male.
Well, you know, I was on like a lot of people Twitter sort of text last night with members of my family, and all the women, the three women on the call on the text, were all saying what you're saying. There was definitely a kind of level of aghastness that the females in my family were feeling. What we saw last night was sort of a metaphor for the last 4 years. Donald Trump won in 2016 through bluster, dominance, and rule breaking. And he's been doing that ever since. Mm-hmm. And nobody, including the press, knows how to contain him. And Democrats are exasperated and feel like they seem weak by comparison, and yet win every contest they've had against Donald Trump and the Republican Party for 4 years. They won last night by just every possible measure. There's two polls out, right? CBS and CNN. Both of them show Biden won, Trump lost. If you just, you know, looked at the spin afterwards on the networks, including Fox, Trump did himself no favors. Even Republicans on CNN were saying that. So it seems like Democrats lose with this guy. They've actually only lost once, and that was in 2016.
Good point. Let me go to Annalise. So Annalise, as I'm listening to Paul, I'm not sure it matters who won or lost last night, because Donald Trump conveyed the message, there's not going to be an election. He's not going to respect the results, Annalise. He's already told us that he's going to use the courts, he's going to use the Congress, he's going to use intimidation, he is going to use any method. He basically reinforced last night, you are focusing on an election. You are looking at win and lose. Annalise, he's not going to embrace the concept of win or lose. He is not going to leave.
Well, and he mobilized his paramilitary, you know, toward that end. When, you know, the headlines are all saying he refused to condemn white supremacy. He didn't refuse to condemn it. He mobilized it. He said to the Proud Boys, stand by. Right. And that's their new logo. Right. They immediately started to celebrate and put up that logo, stand back and stand by. So I think that refusal to condemn is what, you know, is in part what you're all describing. He seemed like he was on too much British Sudafed, which he apparently loves and which is much stronger than American Sudafed. But he absolutely created chaos as a planned strategy. I do believe that. It wasn't desperation. Chaos helps him put his paramilitaries on notice. Yes, he has broken every norm throughout his time as presidency. And yes, I agree that within an election, the Democrats win. But this is dangerous. And I think the gender piece of it is worth mentioning, because during the debates 4 years ago with Hillary, he hovered over her, walked around and hovered over her like a stalker, and people found it creepy. Now he was, you know, he was the schoolyard bully and he was, you know, going after Biden. And I think, you know, out of the three of them, I thought Biden actually held his own pretty well in an impossible situation and at least played to the desires of people for there still to be some of these political norms we've had for a long time. As far as women, my favorite response was a Frank Lutz a Luntz control group in which one woman who had been an undecided voter said she had came in undecided, but she decided to vote for Biden because Trump sounded like a crackhead.
And on that note, Rob Hennelly, I'm going to take that crackhead and then switch to you. Lucky you. I was on the air this week with a moderator of a TV show in Canada, in Toronto, on TV Ontario. His name is Steve Paikin. And we were talking about that the institutions will hold. So I got to ask you a question. Which institution has held? Now, I know Paul has said that he only won one election, which was the election of 2016. But I am looking at not at elections. I'm looking at institutions. I'm looking at Congress. I'm looking at checks and balances. I'm looking at the executive branch. I'm looking at the attorney general. I'm looking at the courts. Tell me an institution that holds. We are looking at as if an election is going to offer us the kind of closure or completion of what the democracy envisions. But in the end, it's the institutions that we actually have to look to, because if the institutions aren't there, the election has no meaning.
I think that it's important here to do a split frame, because this is not just an election. We have to break out of the oppression of this election TikTok, this quadrennial thing where we are in this altered state called the campaign. It's important to understand that at the same time, we're in the midst of a once-in-a-century public health crisis where a million people have died on the planet, more than one in five in the United States, and people are clinging desperately to hold on to the gains we had in places like New York City, where I work as a reporter. And I've never felt that our politics and our discourse have been more disconnected from the circumstance of the American people, where there was actually disinformation. It was unhelpful as a civil defense moment, and we're in the crisis of without parallel in American history. And yet, this discourse is entirely disconnected from the circumstance of the American people.
So Val, you know, last night, you've heard me say this a million times. Val has come on the air with me a number of times. I was screaming at the TV last night. And what was I screaming? The pandemic is the economy. The pandemic is the economy. When Joe was even talking about opening up businesses, he was saying, oh, I'll help get them PPEs. I'll help them clean. I'm like, no. Unless you address the pandemic, all the other things you're talking about doesn't get businesses open, doesn't get schools open. You've got to connect the fact that his failure from the very beginning, even since February, when he knew how it would spread, when he knew how lethal it was, unless you keep saying that over and over again, he gets away with the idea that somehow you can open something as if you can open it in isolation from what Bob just said is killing people, making them sick, and they're not even recovering when they recover.
I thought one of the most important things that Biden said all night was that we have become weaker, sicker, poorer, and more divided. And the problem was that he couldn't talk about this. He couldn't soothe America's soul. He couldn't talk about his platform, what his plans were for the pandemic, for health insurance, for climate change. It was clear to me that Trump had already acknowledged that he's not going to win by counting ballots. And the only way that he's going to win is during that period of November 4th to the inauguration. Whatever he can do to disrupt that process is exactly what he wants to do. He did not come to talk about issues. He did not come to debate. He came to disrupt yet one more process. This was not a debate. And to me, to have any more debates intensifies that danger. And so I'm calling upon the commission presidential debates to stop this. I don't think he can be controlled.
Okay, so Paul, I have been in a very interesting position of moderating a debate between 10 candidates for Congress, Republicans and Democrats, but this is before the primary resolves what's going to happen. So you can imagine 10 people on a stage. It's a complete zoo. And of course, because it is still the primary, every extreme and every flavor of the month is on the stage, including someone that sort of sounded a lot like Donald Trump last night. So can I tell you what I did during the course of the debate? The one that sounded like Donald Trump, I walked over, I moved his chair out, and I said, leave. I asked him to leave the stage. I literally, everybody was like, whoa. And I'm like, sorry, there are rules. You have broken every rule. You ignore everyone who is talking and talk over them. I need to conduct this. You are making it impossible. My question is, I agree with Val. I don't think there should be any more debates. But I also think that there has to be a moment, and I know he didn't have the ability to cut the mic off, but I'm trying to figure out who should have walked off the stage, the moderator or Joe Biden. This was not a debate. When do we begin to understand that you need a spine? And I mean the media, and I mean Joe. Joe walked in for a debate. He didn't get delivered a debate. I'm out of there. And you know what? That is alpha, and that is good. Paul?
Yeah, well, everybody who was rooting for Joe wanted to see him pin Donald to the mat at least once or twice. I'm not sure he did that, but he did have that line, "Will you just shut up, man?" And it was kind of lost in the moment. But remember, the audience for debates are not the 10 or 15% of the public that actually watch the debates. It's everyone else who sees the clips. And my sense is that clip is going to be repeated a lot. I'm not sure I agree that we should shut down the next two debates. The next one, I believe, is a town hall meeting. And I think that's an area where Biden will be able to talk about his issues. And I think it'd be very good for Donald Trump to have to answer to regular Americans and see how he deals with them. So I think it could be useful. I agree with you. You know, this was such a meltdown, such a cluster. I don't think most people who watched it thought that they got anything out of it. They wanted to take a shower afterward. But I will repeat, Joe Biden came out ahead.
Oh, and there's no question. So, Annalise, you're the history professor in the crowd. Yep. So I am looking at this, and I go back to how I got engaged in politics in 1984. The Republican majority leader at the end of the Constitutional Convention, we have one that lasts 6 weeks. Every 10 years, we're supposed to have one. At the end of the Constitutional Convention, we run as citizens. He walks me out the door, and he says to me, "Arnie, what are you doing in the fall?" I happen to be pregnant, Annalise. And he said to me, I looked at him and I said, "I'm having a baby, you know?" And he goes, no, I get that, Arnie. And I said, "What are you asking?" And he said, "Ever thought about serving in the New Hampshire legislature?" And I kind of looked at him completely shocked. And I said, "I don't know how to break this to you, but I think I'm a Democrat. In fact, I think I'm a liberal Democrat." And he could say, "Arnie, we could tell that too." But this is the man that invited me into the political process. The Republican majority leader. That was not 1954, that was not 1964, that was 1984, not that long ago. What is the responsibility of the GOP? They have now created this beast, they have empowered this beast, they feel threatened by this beast, but do they have no sense of allegiance to what they claim is the Constitution they put in their pocket and they walk around, or the flag that they wear on their damn lapel, or what they put over their hand on their heart? I keep trying to figure out, is being there so important that they are willing to sacrifice the future of their country and the future for their children? Do they have no sense of a legacy? That's the part that I am just shocked by. I'm not shocked by Trump. I am shocked by the kind of lobotomy that's happened with the Republicans.
Well, I think you're evoking some nostalgia for the old New England, you know, moderate Republican. And Arnie, I just don't think that exists anymore. I mean, our governor in Vermont, Phil Scott, is playing that part. But I think the Republican Party has been, you know, is now wholly owned, not just by Trump, who I agree with, you know, people who say he's a symptom, not a cause, but owned by racism. Owned by, you know, there was a news article the other day about all the states where they're trying to pass bills that say it's okay to kill protesters, right? If you drive your car through a crowd of protesters, you know, you don't have to face legal ramifications, never mind moral ramifications. So I think the Republican Party as we know it, I mean, he blew it up too. And I think in terms of whether there are more debates, no presidential debate will ever be the same again, in my view. Right. There is, whatever happens after this will have to be a different format. The pretense of dignity, the pretense of substantive discussion is over. And I think the GOP, the veil has been ripped off. And obviously, all you have to do is look at Mitch McConnell, who's been smashing the Constitution right and left over the last few years.
So Bob Hennelly, as I'm listening to Annalise, what I'm thinking is that I have done this immediately. I have then taken everything that happened last night and everything that Donald Trump has said about not respecting the vote, and I have now said it needs to be directed at my Republican governor, who's now up for election. I want my Republican governor to be on the hot seat. He can't say that this is just an embarrassment or this is inappropriate, which is what Chris Sununu said. He said, oh, the actions of the president were inappropriate. Really, what the hell does that mean? What does the word inappropriate mean? That has absolutely, that's like vanilla. And I think what every Republican who's up for re-election, whether it's for city council, whether it's for sheriff, whether it's for governor, they are now going to have to respond to every single thing that Donald Trump did. And I think that's another way to say that actions have consequences. There may not be a Republican Party. There may now be a Trump Party. But then everyone who has the R next to their name is now Donald Trump.
Well, I think that... you know, when you're actually in history, it's hard to understand the context. You know, we look back at 1864 and these key moments, and we're at this point that it's hard to see because there is such chaos. And I think that the reality is for Republicans, power is their country. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. There's no symbolism. It's not abstract. I think the previous speaker mentioned the pretense of dignity. That is an important thing because so much of our civic life was, you know, operating at this superficial level. And now with the stress and strain that's happening on Americans at an unprecedented level, I mean, the decline that's happening, and this is why it's important to hold all elected leaders at all levels responsible. We really don't have accurate measurement for the level of economic destruction that's happened. It's like we're in a plane.
Yes.
Where the altimeter is pinned. No data actually is being collected that gives us a sense of the dislocation that's happening so rapidly and in a matter of just fiscal quarters. And so my concern is that focusing even for a nanosecond on Donald Trump and his machinations distracts us from being the situational awareness that's required because of the unusual circumstance we're in right now.
And I want to go back to something Val says. So Val Andrus is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. She thinks there should not be another debate. So Val, in a way, part of me agrees with you. I said we are living with a pandemic that we have not addressed, okay? And it's going to be getting worse and worse now that we're going into flu season, now that we're going indoors, now that we know that we have bad air circulation. So the level of terrifying with COVID-19 is incredible. And we're finding out that even when you recover, you don't. You have a pre-existing condition, okay? And then I look at what's happening with climate change, and I'm looking at California and Oregon and Washington, and I'm terrified because they're being torched. There will be no more wine coming out of wine country, okay? And then I'm looking at what's going to happen because of the hurricanes and what's going to happen with the flooding. It's not even whether we have a category 4, it's that the rains don't stop. It's that the rains don't stop. And then I'm looking at what's happening on our streets with the race riots and how he's basically sort of encouraging this kind of violence. And then I look at Donald Trump, and I look at the debates. These are four stressful things, incredibly stressful. The only one I can stop on a dime is the frickin' debates. Everything else I gotta live with, Val, but I don't have to live with the debates. That's why when you said that, I wanted to scream because I am looking at my stress level and saying, why do I wanna aid and abet this emotional, economic, and social meltdown? Because that's in part what that debate did last night. It was nothing I could recognize, but I knew that it wasn't healthy, Val.
And I believe what Robert had to say, that power is now the Republicans' elixir. And because of that, I'm even thinking about the town hall debate. We're very naively thinking that politics is now ruled by fairness and civility, and at least there's some modicum of it. I don't doubt that Donald Trump will disrupt a town hall debate. And it's not his purpose to win the hearts and minds of the people who are engaged in those debates. And I have to think about, I'm teaching a class right now of 20 first year students, first generation, many of them working 1 to 3 jobs to stay in school. Many of them never talk about politics around the table. This is their first introduction to politics. And I had emails from 2 students who told me and apologized for the fact that they couldn't take it anymore, that they had to stop watching the debate. And you have to step back from that and think about what we have become. And I don't think that there's a reset on this election. I mean, I still think we're holding out hope that Donald Trump is going to get with the program, and that he will conduct himself in a way that he'll talk about some issues that will give Biden the opportunity to respond. But if you go back and think about what the purposes of debates are, and one of them is to help the voter to sort of sort through the issues. Another purpose is to build confidence in the democratic process. And this is certainly not doing that. I have to think about my students and the responsibility that I have to students and young people that are coming up. It certainly didn't do that last night. And until we can hit that reset button, I think we just need to stop this and maybe focus our attention on what Donald Trump's real intent is. You know, how can we fortify the election? How can we make those votes or those ballots count? Because he did everything but declare war last night.
We need to go to a break, and then we will come back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We are actually Zooming this Wednesday morning, so you will be hearing it live on Wednesday. We are recapping what happened last night. I'm hoping that with my phenomenal panel of guests, we can actually talk about what happens going forward. Paul Glastras from The Washington Monthly, Annalise Orlick from Dartmouth College, Bob Henelis from AdStuckNation and Salon.com and the Chief Leader, and Val Endres from Rhode Island College. We'll be right back.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
A dream catcher is thought to catch bad or negative dreams and is seen as a symbol of unity among Native Americans. The dream catcher meaning derives from an ancient story of a special spider mother whose children moved to all corners of the land. Their mother and grandmother sewed magical webs for her children using cordage made from plants, sinew, and willow hoops. The dream catchers were meant to keep out any bad dreams and promote only good dreams for the children. The Ojibwa people first made the dream catcher, and through intermarriages with other tribes, the concept grew and grew. It wasn't until the 1960s and 1970s that dream catchers grew in their popularity and spread to other cultures to share and enjoy their beauty. The dream catcher meaning has such beauty that you can often see a dream catcher hanging from a porch or a rearview mirror in a car, or as earrings or other jewelry. The lotus flower meaning varies among several different cultures and religions. The lotus flower retracts at night and then emerges beautifully the next morning. The Egyptians associated the lotus flower with the sun, which also disappeared in the nighttime. In Buddhism, the lotus flower meaning is known for exactness, spiritual awakening and purity, because the flower emerges from dark and muddy waters and then transforms into a beautiful flower. In Buddhism, the lotus flower is seen as something that is very clean. In Hinduism, the lotus flower meaning is associated with fruitfulness, spirituality, attractiveness, affluence, eternity, and purity. It is also symbolic that this gorgeous flower emerges from muddy waters. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. It is our phenomenal panel of guests to talk about the interesting conversation last night. I refuse to call it a debate. We are joined by Paul Glastras, who is with The Washington Monthly, Annalise Orlick of Dartmouth College, Robert Henley of The Chief Leader, Salon.com and AdStuckNation, and Val Endres, political communications at Rhode Island College. So, again, I'm going to go back to you, Paul. After watching last night, I wrote something else, and I said, the call from last night is you're in the democracy now. I wanted almost a picture of Uncle Sam. You're in the democracy now. You don't need a gun. You don't need a uniform. But what you need is a mask. You need a voter registration application that's been completed, and you need a damn ballot. That is your job. If there ever was a calling, I'm a child that grew up during the Vietnam War. My father was very, very sort of conservative. I grew up with a lot of folks that were obviously opposed to the Vietnam War. Do you know my response to going into college in 1971 was? I realized that I had a lot of male friends that were drafted. So I decided either all of us go or none of us go. And I actually enlisted in ROTC. I mean, that was my response. You know, I was like so frustrated, but I felt the calling that I needed to be engaged. Of course, the Air Force had no idea what to do with us. So most of us dropped out after the first year. But that was my response. My response wasn't to sort of run away. My response was to get into the thick of it and say, how do I fix this? How do I change this? I am wondering, people are worried about the fact that this is about voter suppression. This is about discouraging people not to vote. Is this a 9/11 moment where people are going to realize they need to step up? They need to work together. They need to be engaged. And if there ever was a moment to fight, this is the moment, Paul.
I agree with what all the other panelists said. What Trump did last night, he knows he's going to lose. He was sending signals to his people to disrupt the coming election. He is painting a picture of fraud and chaos that he himself is creating in order to fight what he pretty much knows is going to be against a pretty big loss for president. And remember, he will no longer have any kind of immunity once he is no longer president. And he's got a court battle and maybe jail time, as do his kids. So this is a very desperate individual. My hope is that enough people, for instance, this audience, this panel, is wise to that and is making plans to not let that happen. But if it does happen, if he does send out troops, if he does send out the Proud Boys, the only real way to stop a coup is for masses and masses of people to peacefully take to the streets. And not just, you know, our kids, right, who have been doing the Black Lives Matter stuff, the moms, you know, people our age, prosperous bourgeois people. It might take weeks. It might take weeks of that kind of work. That's how bad it is. I would say one further thing. The more Donald Trump is beaten profoundly in the ballot box, the less likely any of that is going to happen.
I've been saying exactly that. So not only do I think that we have to show up in every way possible, shape, or form, I said Donald Trump needs to lose in the polls. He needs to lose on Election Day, and he needs to lose after we count all the votes. It's got to be a trifecta. There can't be anything. And I know that they're going to be using the courts to their advantage because they're going to fight every vote. They're going to fight every address. They're going to fight everything. But I'm kind of curious. I know that he packed the bench. I know he's packing the Supreme Court. But I want to sit down with the Federalist Society, since they're the ones that picked all those judges. And I want to sort of talk to the Federalist Society. Are all those judges rubber stamps for this kind of crap? Are all those judges, I don't care how conservative or reactionary they are, but they do have some kind of, I'm hoping, intellectual ability to understand what is going on here. And is he making an assumption all those people with all those robes on are in his pocket and will do his bidding like Bill Barr?
Oh, yeah. No, he's absolutely making that assumption. He operates like a mob boss, and he thinks that he has done what he needs to instill loyalty, and he expects people to be loyal. I don't think every judge will be. We've seen that two of his appointees, Gorsuch, even Kavanaugh, and certainly John Roberts, has not done everything that he would have liked. But I want to come back to Paul's comment, and I also want to come back to something you said earlier about race riots. I was at a number of these protests. I did not see race riots. I saw incredibly well-organized, peaceful protests full of young people of all backgrounds, and some people our age as well, masked. And they give me hope. I mean, I read a statistic that said something like 29% of young African Americans, you know, 18% of young white people, and similar numbers of other groups have been out there in the streets. So they recognize what is necessary. And I think, sadly, that what it may come to, you asked how to prevent him from not leaving, is that moment when he tries to call out the military, as he did in Lafayette Park. Came out, but it caused a split in the military and, you know, people who felt that their oath was to the Constitution, not to Donald Trump, were torn. And I'm really sorry to say it, but I think that is where we're going to have to go. If I believed that the military would, you know, would respond to what he asked, then I would think it's all over. And I don't. I think those young people give me hope, and that may be the crisis we're looking at, even though you're right that voting and a landslide is, you know, maybe also necessary.
So Bob, as I'm listening to Annalise, you know why you need that incredible trifecta of overwhelming response? Is that actually is the sign to the military. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I can't believe that Annalise Orlik is talking about the military as maybe the solution for removing Donald Trump. Do you realize what a crazy world we're living in? You know, I remember all my friends who looked at me when I joined RTC and they're like, you're a sellout, you're this, how could you have done this? And now I'm looking at all my friends basically sort of suggesting that maybe it's going to be the military that we're going to turn to. But Bob Hennelly, let me tell you something. The military needs to hear from the American people because that is who they represent. They represent the Constitution. They represent the American people. They represent who we are as a nation. And if the nation doesn't speak out in a way that can be heard, that means that everyone basically is being given no direction. And that's exactly what Donald Trump wants. He wants no message because no message then gives him a license to do whatever he wants.
I would say it's important to understand that the military as an institution is in severe crisis. The suicides that are going on, coronavirus, which is totally underreported, has wrecked all kind of havoc there all around the world. And it shows you the blind spot that you don't see any reference to this at all, except earlier on the aircraft carrier that got so much attention. It's also important to understand that there are elements within the military, which was not discussed last night, where we have an active duty Air Force sergeant who was arrested with an affinity for the Boogaloo Boys that executed and assassinated an African-American Department of Homeland Security uniformed guard. That's real time. And Joe Biden has to be more nimble and remind people about that. The dead bodies that are related are to this right-wing thing that Trump is playing to and trying to enable. I would suggest also that elections don't happen in TV. People do need to do more than vote. They need to get involved with groups like the National Lawyers Guild and be present. I also think that Trump and the American labor movement need to be prepared for general strike, which they should have done when Donald Trump abused the 2 million federal employees and had them work without pay. I mean, I wrote about Bureau of Prison people that were literally not being able to buy food for their families because they had to pay to commute from the hills of Pennsylvania to lower Manhattan to keep the prison secure. It's time for labor to step up in a significant way, any kind of social organization. And also, local public unions need to hold their local PBA accountable for their decision to back Donald Trump and take this fight into the PBA union halls by pointing out that this is the president whose failed COVID response by pitting the states against each other has resulted in scores of deputy sheriffs, detectives who are dead from coronavirus.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up the police because that was one of the most amazing sort of fact-checked statements that Donald Trump made last night, Val Indres, where he said that the Portland sheriff or the chief of whatever it is was basically had endorsed Donald Trump. I mean, he said that. I mean, once again, he has all the police unions and he challenged, you know, Joe Biden about that. And then to bring Portland into the conversation and say, even the sheriff in Portland is behind me. And the sheriff went apoplectic because absolutely not true. So there is more stuff oozing out. But I want to go to Bob's comment. How do we deal with these police unions? Because it does create the impression that if there is going to be stability and law and order, and if Donald Trump has the, you know, the heads of these police unions supporting him, there is sort of a connection. What I want to remind the police unions of, Val, is that Donald Trump is not bailing out the states and bailing out the cities and towns. Who pays the damn police? Well, you know what? That's who gets paid. So as Donald Trump is claiming to bring them in and bring them close to his breast, he's also saying, and you're not going to get a paycheck because there ain't going to be any money. And again, that's where I wanted Joe Biden to look at the cops and say, let's do a little math here. He doesn't care about you. He's freaking using you. Val?
And I don't think that Biden last night articulated in any way useful information about what he believes about the police. He had talked about this old trope about a few bad apples and we shouldn't throw, you know, the police away just simply because of some bad behavior. But there really does have to be institutional reform. I can't believe that he doesn't believe that. You know, I think that eventually he knows, and the first obligation that he has is to explain what it means to defund the police and to get away from those myths that Donald Trump is spreading about what exactly that means. But going back to Robert's idea about unions have a responsibility, I also think members of the media have a responsibility. Because if this election is not decided in a landslide, then there are a couple of things that they need to do. They need to talk to the public often, every day, all the time, about the fact that this election probably will not be decided on election night. If it's a close election, and it happens to be in one of the contested states, this could go on into January. And so they have to talk about the idea that this is our process working as it should, and especially during a pandemic. The other thing that they have to make decisions about is if Donald Trump declares himself the winner, are they going to cover that? And how are they going to respond to that? And they can prepare for that now, saying, and they have the election statisticians there, they will know when to call the election, not Joe Biden, not Donald Trump. And so I think they need to make some decisions and educate the public about that. This shouldn't be a surprise to people that on election night, we're not going to have an answer.
So, Paul, there's all these questions about the media, and you've been doing media work for a long time, so that's why I want to go back to you. So the New York Times has come out with this series of incredible investigative stories about Donald Trump's taxes. You know, what's interesting is, you know, a book I have right by my bed, you're going to laugh at this. David K. Johnson, I've known for years. I met him after he wrote a book called Perfectly Legal. And Perfectly Legal was basically about our tax system and what we think should be immoral, illegal, unconscionable. Basically, it was created to aid and abet the wealthy, okay? They don't pay, but we pay. You know, there's absolutely, and I still have it by my bed because in a lot of ways, it was one of the reasons I ran for governor because of what is perfectly legal that actually harms so many people. And I am looking at this story of Donald Trump and his taxes, and I got to ask, they've been sitting on this for a while. I don't believe that this... Was the timing of this release of this tax information useful or not useful as we go into the chaos of these last couple of weeks? That's kind of my question. I mean, to do it literally within hours of the debate was somewhat shocking, but I'm just trying to figure out, the media also plays an interesting role because they're the gatekeeper of their information. They know when to release and when not. Mr. Washington Monthly, what do you think of their timing?
Well, I love their timing in the sense that it was well-timed to disrupt the debate and hand Joe Biden a weapon, which he used a little bit, but I think it's going to be a weapon that can be used quite a bit over the next few weeks. The Times obviously has had this data, these documents for some time, because it did a lot of reporting around it. So I think that the timing of the leak is less important than the timing of the publishing of it. But, you know, take it from me, no self-respecting outlet sits on a great story that they fear others might get to longer than they have to. So my guess is that they played it straight and they dropped it, you know, when it was done and not much later. You know, you'd love to paint a picture of a Svengali manipulating things. I don't think that's what happened here.
Okay. So, Annalise, I'm terrified of Donald Trump, but that's not news. What actually really frightens me is Bill Barr. Of all the characters that we're talking about, I don't look at the courts, I don't look at Mitch McConnell, I look at William Barr. First of all, he's incredibly smart. Second of all, he clearly has become Donald Trump's Roy Cohn. He also is what? He's the head of justice. You know, when you think about the title, and in a lot of ways, that's been always kind of the Velcro is this sort of sense that we have justice, and yet this man is in charge. How do we deal with Bill Barr? To me, that is a pivot point that Was it always in the game plan as we moved into this election that we would have this toxic attorney general?
Well, first of all, Roy Cohen was Donald Trump's Roy Cohen. Trump learned much of the rule book for how he operates in the political world from Roy Cohen, right? Never apologize, always be on the offensive, you know, have your power brokers at your back, you know, and for Roy Cohen often was the Archbishop of New York. Barr is that person, and I think he's an important link between, you know, the racist, right-wing, white supremacist upsurge that, you know, in our culture that has backed Donald Trump and the establishment Republican Party, right? William Barr was George H.W. Bush's attorney general, right? And so I think that's something that we really need to understand. And that's part of what makes him so frightening. He has links to old money, to power. And I think it comes back to this question of perfectly legal, right? I mean, Trump is using the old fascist playbook of doing everything in plain sight and seeing if there will be enough pushback. Not to make facile comparisons to Hitler, but that's exactly what Hitler did. Let's see what happens now. Will the world respond? Will anyone answer? That is the strategy, and Barr is his architect. You know, we've had attorney generals before who were an embarrassment. Jeff Sessions turned out to have a moral red line, which is hard to imagine, but I'm thinking about, you know, Meese under Reagan and John Mitchell under Nixon. This is not the first time that the attorney general has been lawless and manipulated the justice system. And I think Barr can be defeated, but it's really important to remember that the whole of the bulk of the Republican Party is behind him and behind this.
So, Bob, let me sort of dream. And I want to dream that somehow Joe Biden is now president. He now has this incredibly fractured nation that he has to actually sort of figure out how to lead. If you were Biden, what's the first thing you would do? How do you message from the day you take office that not only is this different, but that the message is both a powerful message to the country that, you know, he keeps saying, I don't care about red America, about blue America, about, you know, whatever. He's got this sort of, you know, the old school, I care about, you know, the United States of America. What is it that he could do? Does he tell you now or does he just wait? But what would it be?
Well, I think that he immediately has to, because this is going to be, imagine we're going to be a couple of hundred thousand more dead bodies into this, assuming your rosy scenario, right? How ironic is that? That he immediately needs to turn on a dime this very tragic national circumstance, which is growing more dire by the day, where Donald Trump has turned the federal government into a predator state. And I mean that precisely what I'm saying, a killer predator state that has turned the states against each other so that we still, even as we speak now, have a shortage of personal protective equipment. And he needs to pull that together and bring the states together. And he has some willing partners that are both who have acquitted them well, some Republican governors, Hogan in Maryland, who have acquitted themselves well, and bring that into a steering committee on day one to turn this around.
I also think that the idea is that he needs to be ready. So one of the things I keep saying is the pandemic is the economy. The pandemic is the economy. Bob just said that there are going to be thousands more dead. Schools are falling apart. Talk to any teacher about what it's like to be in a classroom. That's if they're in a classroom. How long the classroom is going to continue to exist. Talk to people who are, you know, in higher ed, and you're hearing it. One of the things I keep thinking about is that I don't know if there's going to be a vaccine. And I know that I've used this expression over and over again, that mask wearing is kind of a crude vaccine, okay? And that's, and in a way, he needs to say that. He needs to say, until we get the vaccine that works, this is a vaccine that won't kill you. This is a vaccine that won't have complications. This is a vaccine that you could just wear and wash. You know what I mean? And in a way, he needs to reframe the mask and take the mask away from Donald Trump so that people truly understand that it's about saving their lives and saving the lives of others. The other thing I think he also needs to do is he needs to prepare for some kind of instant testing. Not testing that's 48 hours, not like the kind that, you know, when you get a pregnancy test. You just dip it into your urine, you go, whoop, I'm having a baby. Well, and I think if he can do those two things, what he has done for everyone is give them a sense that he truly does want to open the economy and he truly does want to address the pandemic. bing, bing, this has to happen day one, because it begins to address everything that actually frightens everyone, whether they're in a red state or a blue state.
The transition team just can't be planning the inauguration. And I couldn't agree with you more. They have to have a plan in place on day one. And we hear that word all the time with new challengers who become president, that on day one, they have a lot to do. And his first 100 days, we always look at it as an optimum time for a president to change the direction and the barometer of politics. That's when the honeymoon stage is going on. To me, the first 100 days mark our survival. I think in many ways, he's going to have to think in ways that Roosevelt thought about. You know, we need a work progress administration. We need to get people back to work. We need to issue checks. We need to work on climate change. We need to work on the infrastructure that has, you know, Trump has done nothing or virtually nothing about. There is a confluence of problems, but this all depends upon the fact of whether we have a Senate majority. You know, he can't do all of this by executive order. And so that's why I'm thinking that as we are gathering the troops to hit the streets and to talk about this election, we have to think about the Senate and maintaining the House. Because there's an awful lot for Joe Biden to do, and he can't do it alone.
I think the House and the Senate is absolutely crucial. And we've seen the Senate because of what's happened with the courts. I mean, right there, how many hundreds of people have the ability to appoint? I'm looking at this sort of trial. So if we have the House and the Senate and we have the presidency, do we really care about the Supreme Court? Can we just sort of nail down, I mean, I'm kind of serious here. Can we nail down legislatively, even things that we know are going to the court, maybe issues about healthcare, maybe and actually define it so there is no confusion, to make the decisions that are being asked of the court moot, because what we've done is we've clarified or we've added closure. I am actually looking at this stuff going, what's in the pipeline going to the Supremes? Can I address that before it actually even gets there?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. Let me add that presuming Democrats get control of the Senate, in addition to all the necessary work that needs to be done to pull the country together to deal with the pandemic, to pull the country together to deal with unemployment, Democrats and the Biden administration have to understand, you know, on the airlines when they say, telling you how to protect yourself, put the mask on yourself first and then turn to your neighbor.
Yes.
Democrats have to put the political mask on themselves first. What I mean by that? They need to do the tough stuff, like making DC a state, like having universal money for universal vote by mail. There, maybe Puerto Rico, if they'll go along, right? Things that are going to drive the right crazy and be very divisive, quote unquote. But Democrats can only retain power if more citizens vote. Republicans can only retain power if fewer citizens vote. That's the basic arithmetic of American politics right now. So Democrats have to protect themselves to survive in 2022, to survive 2024, and they've got to really be focused on getting and holding power and changing the electoral ground such that they can do the other things they want to do.
So, Annalise, I've always said that Joe Biden leads from behind. Okay, that's been my favorite. But then he becomes the moment. He becomes the moment. And I'm hearing what Paul said about putting the mask on Democrats first. And what I'm thinking is, do we think that Joe Biden has the capacity to sprint? This is not about doing what Paul says. This is about doing it in a fashion that Democrats have always been reluctant to do. Republicans slam dunk. It's over. It's done. Democrats go, no, we got to go. In a way, they've got to put on their running shoes and they've got to move quickly because we don't have time, not just because of this election, but because of the pandemic, because of climate change, because of race relations, because of all these things, that time is of the essence. Does Joe comprehend that? And if not, who around him can help him get there?
Well, I think that he does. And in terms of leading from behind, he has evoked, you know, the name of Franklin Roosevelt and the idea of a New Deal. And, you know, even Bernie is saying he thinks he might have the most progressive administration since Roosevelt. So he's looking back. I think he grasps an opportunity. His climate change plan, though not, you know, what the Sunrise Movement would have chosen themselves, has been praised by them. His police plan, though not what Black Lives Matter necessarily is calling for, is a move toward bringing mental health professionals and EMTs in for the majority of 9/11 calls that are not, you know, about crime. So I think he does grasp the moment. And it is also my hope that with people like Liz Warren and you know, and Sanders and a wide range of people and his very smart vice presidential choice, hopefully he will take the ball and run with it, even if it means looking behind.
I have to thank the four of you for contributing today. I told Val before she came on the air, I wanted to just run an hour of silence because I did not know what we could say. I really did. And I'm also in regret that what's happened with social media is that it's given us instant gratification, and that's not real, and that's not life. And this is an election that will not be instant gratification. This is an election, as you pointed out, Val, we may need to learn to do something we've never done, wait. Patience is not necessarily an American virtue. I am very lucky to have all four of you join us. Paul Glastras, Washington Monthly, Annalise Orlick, history professor at Dartmouth College, Bob Hennelly from Salon.com, the chief leader at StuckNation, InsiderNJ.com, and Val Endres, a professor of political communication at Rhode Island College. I am honored to share this hour with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, my great producer, Stephanie Collins, and Dave Stott. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You better-